This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. The Base Realignment and Closure Commission, or BRAC, is an agency of the United States federal government which aims to dispose of unnecessary U.S. Department of Defense real estate. This aims to increase efficiency in line with congressional and Department of Defense objectives. More than 350 installations have been closed in five rounds of BRAC, and there's another round of BRAC closing set for 2015. And that has San Antonio leaders concerned, including San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro. He's working to make a strong case for local bases. I spoke to Castro on Friday about BRAC.
Well, the Department of Defense has asked to do another BRAC round in 2015. And so yesterday, I sent out a letter with about 26 other colleagues, Republicans and Democrats, asking the Department of Defense and Secretary Hagel that if they intend to do another BRAC round, that they first look at excess capacity in overseas bases before making decisions to close domestic operations.
Now, that's something that former Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison had also brought forth, saying that it looks like that we may have some excess capacity overseas, and that should be looked at first.
That's right. There was a BRAC round in 2005, and prior to that, Senator Hutchison led an effort, which also was bipartisan at that time, and had the support of Texans in Congress to make sure that, you know, whatever closures we went through, first there was an assessment of overseas capacity, and the overseas closures were done first. So that was an effort made back then, and we want to make sure that, you know, we make the same push this year.
So why are we doing more BRAC? Why is this part of the overall political consensus that we need to contract what we're spending in government-wise?
Well, I think the reason that the Department of Defense wants to do another BRAC round is because, you know, in the intervening years since 2005, of course, we've withdrawn from Iraq. We will have withdrawn from Afghanistan in 2014. And so there's a kind of winding down process, which on one hand is understandable. But, you know, what those of us who signed the letter are asking is that the Department of Defense first assess what international capacity, excess capacity there may be before affecting domestic operations. I think all of us understand that the primary purpose of the United States military is first to keep the American people safe, but also to, you know, keep our allies safe around the world. We understand that it's not a jobs program, but we also want to make sure that when there are going to be military assets in the Department of Defense, that the domestic ones are protected first, rather than any excess capacity overseas.
Yeah, we know that the military is not a jobs program, but it does provide jobs, and we certainly feel that the jobs that we have in San Antonio are necessary and needed, and we'd hate to have them cut if it doesn't have to happen. So what's happening in San Antonio in case there is another round of BRAC? How do we, you know, gear up to make the people who make these decisions aware of how significant San Antonio is for military readiness?
Well, once upon a time, of course, our city had five military bases. And since the mid-1990s, we went to the closures of Brooks and Kelly Air Force Base. Kelly Air Force Base in particular was so important to the life of the city. It had literally helped usher thousands of families into the middle class in San Antonio. And that was a real jolt when it closed. Now, the silver lining in that is that we got the San Antonio Port Authority. And since then, we've gotten wonderful employers like Boeing and Lockheed Martin, Standard Aero, and others. So we were able to turn that minus into a kind of plus. But now that we're facing the prospect of another BRAC round, we want to make sure that all of the operations in San Antonio are running as efficiently as possible, and also make sure that everybody in the community is doing everything they can to reach out to elected officials, to folks in Washington, to let them know how we feel about this.
And there are some folks in Washington, D.C., Senator Durbin particularly, they want assurances that BRAC actually saves money. They're not convinced that when we close bases and we're just kind of doing a shell game, So how does that look?
That's right. One of the other concerns among members of Congress has been that the BRAC closures themselves, because when you close a base, you don't just turn the lights off. You know, there's remediation often that has to be done, moving different assets around, personnel, et cetera. And so that's very costly. In fact, we've still not fully paid for the last BRAC round. We're still billions of dollars to go in terms of paying that off. So we want to make sure that if we're going to do another BRAC round, that financially it makes sense.
Now, there was a House subcommittee on Thursday rejected any notion of BRAC in the 2015 budget.
That's right. There are many folks who feel that we shouldn't even go down the road of another BRAC round at this point. And so, you know, the Armed Services Committee, I imagine, will have a chance to fully vet that suggestion by the Department of Defense. But in the meantime, you know, we wanted to send out this letter to make sure that if there is a BRAC round, that international bases or the excess capacity international bases is considered first.
So,
and I think that, you know, during this debate, I think we should bear in mind that there are about 148,000 active duty personnel, military personnel in Texas. Texas is third in terms of the states that have the highest military presence. So there's a lot at stake here for Texas. There are 15 major military installations here. Obviously the economic generation from all of that is billions and billions of dollars to our state and to San Antonio. So this is something that we're watching with a close eye.
So we just had the sequester, or we are continuing to experience the sequester, depending how you want to look at it. And we saw some automatic cuts happening to defense. And that's not a very effective way of managing dollars to have effect. But going through a BRAC process where we evaluate and look at each individual facility and question and if its effectiveness seems to be a more elevated way of, you know, how are we going to spend our tax dollars?
Right. No, that's right. You know, the sequester was a very sloppy way to cut the budget. And so the problems that we're getting into now with the 11 furlough days, for example, for civilian employees who work with the military, it's gotten tough, not only for those employees, but also for the military folks they work with in terms of them accomplishing their roles and doing their jobs. And so you need to go through a very thoughtful, thorough process where you make cuts that make sense in areas that make sense, not just across the board.
San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro is working to build a case for local military bases so they could remain safe if there is another round of BRAC closings. I spoke to Castro on Friday. There's more Source coming up. We hear from Texas Public Radio's Capitol correspondent Ryan Poppy about wrapping up the Texas legislative session. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're now under 9 hours till the conclusion of the 83rd legislative session in Austin. And the words, "Thank you, sir, may have another," can be heard under the Capitol's pink dome because there's little doubt that a special session will be called for the summer and state lawmakers will have to take up business that didn't get done and resurrect bills that were killed in the process. To get an update on the last hours of the legislative session and to recap the highs and lowlights of the 83rd, Ryan Poppy is TPR's Austin Bureau correspondent, is on the line. Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
So, Ryan, the only job required for the legislature is to come up with a budget that will fund the state for the next 2 years. How would you characterize the budget and what were the fights fought to get it passed?
Well, you know, it's funny that that is the only job that legislators really are constitutionally held to each session, but it was one of the very last things that happened as far as things to get passed. And a lot of people have complained that it was because it was broken apart and three sections that everyone had to kind of keep track of all these different moving parts and where the votes were happening. And then there were a lot of changes that happened to one. Well, that affected another. So that made it a very confusing, I think, for even the architects of those bills, because you have to have 100 votes in the House, more than two-thirds majority, to make those things pass. Any other piece of legislation, that rule doesn't always necessarily apply, but when it comes to the budget, it's pretty strict. I mean, in the House, you have to have 100 votes. In the Senate, it's got to be a two-thirds majority. So, like I said, it was a little bit confusing on, when these were happening and as they were happening. And there was a lot of changes that happened along the way. The Senate Bill 1, that's the main budget bill by Senator Tommy Williams of the Woodlands. He had added a bunch of things and taken out a bunch of things. And at the last minute, one of those was a contingency clause that this House Bill 7, which regards the Systems Benefit Fund. That's a fund for elderly Texans and impoverished Texans to help them pay their electricity bill.
And that's only for commercial privatized utilities. Doesn't impact CPS or Austin Electric, mainly for the Valley, Houston, Austin areas.
That's correct.
And so everyone pays a little bit extra on their bill, and that goes into a special fund, which is supposed to help the indigent pay their power bills. But however, that money was being diverted and held in a special account to balance previous budgets.
That's correct. And that's what he wanted to do, was take that money out and issue everyone sort of a rebate check that had paid into it. And so that was, like I said, a contingency clause. Democrats in the House were not very happy with that because, like you say, it was set up to help the indigent. So you had a lot of people raising stink about that. One in particular, Houston Democrat Sylvester Turner.
Right. He had set up the fund. He authored the fund when the Texas deregulated electricity.
That's right. And so, it was kind of a real slap in the face, I think, for him. I don't know if it was done towards him. But that all was the money that was in Senate Bill 1 for education, the $200 million remaining to get us to that 3.9 mark, which is what Democrats were asking for. That was all contingent on that passing. As well as another part of the budget in 1025, and that was the supplemental spending bill.
We're kind of getting bogged down in technocratic talk here, so let's just get to the meat of it. So the House did pass the budget. It's for $197 billion, and the eventual vote was 118-29.
That's correct.
Was it the Democrats that were the hard ones to lasso in on this vote, or was it the Tea Party freshman Republicans? Who was it that held out?
Well, actually, once the education component of the budget was satisfied, you saw Democrats really ease back. And it was after that point, it was these Tea Party freshmen that they ask a lot of questions. They want to know about everything. They want to know that, if we're going to provide $500 million for roads, that that's not tied to toll roads. So convincing them after that point was the other, probably the biggest challenge. Representative Jim Pitts, one of the main architects of the budget.
Of Waxahachie?
Yes, Waxahachie Republican Representative Jim Pitts. He was one of those to point that out, that this session, that was one of the biggest challenges, is a lot of these Tea Party Republicans are fireballs when it comes to asking questions and making sure that everyone's accountable.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. We love questions. We love keeping people accountable. As you said, the Tea Party is not really happy with the budget. I got an email blast this morning from one Tea Party organization saying, alerting people, saying spending up 26% with the Texas legislature. It takes a wild turn to the left, spending like there's no tomorrow. But according to Reuters, the Texas budget is up 8.3% increase from the previous cycle. So I'm not sure how they got 26%. What are you hearing?
Well, you know, there was also that. I think the Reuters number is a little closer to the correct one there. To put it in Senator Tommy Williams' words, this is a very conservative budget. You know, it didn't fully restore a lot of the cuts that were taken in the 2011 session. You know, there was a lot of room, and it didn't really bust the spending cap. In fact, there's a lot of bills waiting in the wings that Governor Dewhurst wants to see to readjust that number, and you know, so that we don't go over it.
So let's talk about this. Let's talk about the yeah. education spending. You said that there was a spending cut in the last legislative session, a little over $5 billion. There was talk of restoring that. It was not fully restored. What did we end up with?
We ended up with $3.9 billion, and that's broken into three parts. The main budget provided $3.4 billion. Then you saw another $200 million in the supplemental bill, and that brings it, or 3.2 rather, in the main bill. Then you saw another 200 in the supplemental bill, and then finally, what you have for the remaining part is, I believe, 1.2 billion in property tax readjustment. So we did better as far as property tax appraisals as a state, so they would give that back to the districts.
But there are Democrats who are saying that we took out the $5 billion last session. That was because, you know, Texas continues to grow. They say 1,000 new people move to Texas every state. So new schools have to be put up to accommodate all these new people. And then we restored only $4 billion. And so if you're looking at the formula and the numbers of people who are coming into the state, we're not keeping up. We're falling further behind, but we're not falling as far behind as we were before.
You know, that definitely seems the case. You know, the other issue, too, that sort of goes in line with that, and I think this is what kind of Republicans may be hoping for, at least Republicans like Houston Senator Dan Patrick, is that, you know, some of the weight gets taken off Texas by opening up 305 charter schools by 2016, private charter schools, mostly by out-of-state companies to come in and, you know, address these failing schools or these ones that are struggling, be able to take them over and erect a charter school and put that in their place. And so, you know, we're not funding it as much. A lot of people like Senator Letitia Vandepute see that we're, you know, we may be just putting a Band-Aid on these kind of schools and these issues rather than really addressing it, restoring the funding, and, you know, making sure that we're adequately taking care of our student body.
Going into the session, education reform was a big part of what we heard. And Senator Dan Patrick, who was the head of the Senate Education Committee, had a lot of things on his agenda that he wanted to get passed, particularly with school choice, which didn't happen. But also we heard a lot about the reform of standardized testing. What did we end up with that?
Well, we went from 15 to 5. With the STARS test right now, we have 15 tests. We're brought that down to 5. And we've made them less high stakes,
okay.
If that makes sense. There's a lot more flexibility.
So I'm kind of running out of time here, this is the lightning round. Let's kind of move through some of these things real quick. Term limits,
sure.
That was something that State Representative Lyle Larson of San Antonio wanted to see passed, along with the reimbursement for campaign expenditures. What happened on that?
Both died. One died in the process. One, after meeting with Governor Perry, died shortly after that.
There's also a lot of talk about putting some restrictions on payday lenders in the state. And did that ever happen?
No, it did not. It got to be a heated topic in the Senate, and you saw it shortly go away after that. And even San Antonio Representative Mike Villarreal had something to kind of bring it back. Unfortunately, he was the only one on his committee that really wanted to see that get out of committee and get debated.
We're talking about using rainy day funds for water projects to deal with Texas drought. Where's that standing?
Right now we have the funds set up. That's going to be part of something that voters get to decide on in the fall of this year.
So a constitutional amendment.
Account. Right. The funding for it comes in 1025, the supplemental bill, and that'll be $2 billion for, the next 50 years of water projects.
And so there's also a lot of talk about beer, bringing some beer freedom to the state. What happened on that?
Oh, man. Well, hooray beer. it was, they did decide to allow microbrewers to be able to sell their craft beyond their establishment. So that nice pale ale or that lager that you enjoy at your favorite watering hole, that may be, kind of a home craft brew, you'll be able to now find that in HEBs.
That was passed?
Yes.
And that goes into effect on September the 1st?
That's correct.
All right, Ryan Poppe, Austin correspondent for Texas Public Radio, thank you so much for your great coverage over the legislative session. You've got a special session coming up, so you're going to be busy still. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Nick.
This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back after NPR News. Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. This is a Memorial Day edition of The Source, and we're not able to take your calls today, but we will be back tomorrow, fully loaded and fully interactive, ready to take your phone calls. It's safe to say that without the Civilian Conservation Corps, or the CCC, Texas would not have the much-loved and robust state park system that we have today. The CCC was a product of the FDR New Deal. It was a federal social program that put the nation's youth to work when there were no jobs during the Great Depression. The jobs built roads, bridges, dams, and parks that we still enjoy today. From Palo Duro Canyon to Lake Corpus Christi, the breathtaking beauty of the state parks would have been lost if not for the CCC. That's what Cynthia Brandymart shows us in her book, State Parks and the CCC, the Legacy of the Civilian Conservation Corps. Brandymart is the director of the Historic Sites and Structures Program at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department.
Many young men were out of work and out of hope. And FDR had a long-standing interest in the rejuvenating powers of nature. And he put two and two together, and we're very lucky that he did. That is, getting young men who had no jobs, getting them out in nature, building state and national parks, doing soil erosion control projects, planting trees, that the young men would earn $25 a month or $30 a month, send the bulk of it back home, and thus have their families at home taken care of. Meanwhile, the country gets parks. So that was basically the circumstance. There were many veterans, two who were unemployed, and so after several years, when the Corps was primarily for men 16, 17, 18 years of age at least, then some of the older gentlemen were able to enroll.
FDR, when he was governor of New York, he had started a similar program, but that was before the Depression. He became president and started the New Deal programs, and this was one of the most popular New Deal programs that he had created.
Yes, 1933 is when the national program began. And you're right, even even, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, there were, even in Europe, there were what were called work camps where young men would be rehabilitated, some in Germany after World War One, as a matter of fact. But it was viewed at that time as a way to heal the body and soul. And indeed, it healed many a body on the CCCers because they gained weight, they gained muscle, they gained skills, they prepared them for productive lives in most cases.
Yeah, they got three hots in a cot. May not have been really hot, but, you know, they
yeah,
did get to eat.
Yeah, bologna sandwiches.
Yeah, but they got to eat, which was, you know, at that time, yeah. People have a hard time really right now understanding how difficult it was for families, especially in Texas at the time. We had the Dust Bowl. We had all sorts of economic issues in the state. Families were struggling.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked to so many of the former enrollees, and to give you just one of many examples of how impoverished many Texas families were, one gentleman said that he'd never seen a toothbrush before he went into the CCC, that he used soda and a wash rag before, but they had no money. And many of these young men, it was the first time they were off the farm, and they would be helped by their county welfare agents who would qualify them. And it was a lucky thing. It was a lucky transition. Many of the young men who were stationed at the parks around the state, they were not only fed, but the families at home were fed by their salaries.
Got paid $30 a month, but 25 mm-hmm. of it went mm-hmm. to your home.
Uh-huh. And so what also happened is the status of the CCC boys was elevated, because to have that $5 of discretionary income during the Great Depression was it helped not only the boys, it helped the economies of these local communities. Everyone wanted a CCC company, a camp, and a park in their backyard. And so there was a close relationship between the camp and the communities.
Well, let's talk about the legacy mm-hmm. that is at the Texas State Parks today.
Mm-hmm.
The work that they did is beautiful and astonishing, especially when you figure that they didn't really have all the high-powered tools that we have today to do all that.
No, they really didn't. In fact, some of them joke in the interviews it was a pick and a shovel. Time was not the key factor, although some of the camps had heavy machinery, especially where they were building dams and such. But road work was pretty slow going. Chipping out stone from the ground was extremely slow going. In the Texas heat, it was pretty amazing that they crafted these wonderful buildings. And they didn't do it alone. I mean, there were extremely talented architects and landscape architects and planners who were similarly unemployed during the 1930s. And happily, with this program, the National Park Service hired these individuals, and they were stationed in a region, usually in the state they were from, and many of them worked in conjunction with the state parks board, and that was a case in Texas. It was out of Austin, and today we have 29 CCC parks that are open to the public and very popular.
What was the state of the Texas park system prior to the CCC?
There were a few historic sites that had been swept into the Board of Control at that point, and they were managed locally by a local committee. There were no funding streams at that particular point, and there were a few 100 acres, approximately 500 acres around our huge state. Pat Neff, who had begun the state... Governor Neff had started the state Texas State Parks Board in 1923 with no funding. So he relied on small highway stops and picnic spots around the state, people to donate money.
Well, we have a park named for his mother.
We do. We have Mother Neff State Park, and in just south of Waco, and it is a beautiful one. Some of my favorite. If I were traveling this Memorial Day, I would head to the Davis Mountains and be really cool, or I would go to Balmoray and swim, or go to the Frio River and Garner State Park. They're blessed with some beautiful architecture and some cool temperatures, and certainly in Balmoray and Garner State Park, some cool waters.
So at Garner State Park in Uvalde, named mm-hmm. for the vice president to FDR, who famously said being vice president wasn't worth a bucket of spit, but you do get a state park out of it, I guess.
Uh-huh.
What should I look for if I'm at Garner to see the evidence of the hard work of the CCC guys?
Well, there's a wonderful concession building there, and generations of Texans have danced on that dance floor that was created by the Civilian Conservation Corps. There's all sorts of stonework and terracing. There are cabins that have recently been remodeled. There had been many, many more planned. However, because of World War II, some of the funding of the CCC was clipped, and only 16 of them were built. 14 are open to the public today, and you can certainly look to the evidence of those beautiful wood and stone cabins that are very, very popular, and dance on that dance floor.
We're talking with Cynthia Brandemart of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department about her book on the Civilian Conservation Corps and the building of the Texas State Parks that we enjoy today. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas State Parks and the CCC, The Legacy of the Civilian Conservation Corps. That's the name of the book, and I'm talking to the author, Cynthia Brandemart, of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Let's get back to our conversation. The Blanco State Park, they have mm-hmm. the dam and wading pool. That was constructed by the Civilian Conservation Corps?
Yes, and if you're in central Texas and you want to keep cool, I would go there. They have a nice picnic tables and a pavilion that is beautiful, made out of the native limestone, and it's a great open feel to it.
How many generations of kids have grown up playing in those waters, you know, and then not knowing that, you know, the legacy, that these were not always there. This is something that was constructed by kids who were, you know, basically on the verge of starvation in the Great Depression. A federal program came along, rounded them up, gave them something to do, and made good out of that.
It is an amazing story when you see 16 and 17 year old frolic in the river down there, and to think that their counterparts some 80 years ago were actually constructing it. Blanco would be a lovely place to spread a picnic on one of their 70-foot picnic tables. I mean, it's something to behold.
So let's talk about your book that you put together, the Texas State Parks and the CCC, The Legacy of the Civilian Conservation Corps. How did you intend people to use the book? Is this something that I should, if I want to go on my cross-country Texas tour, and I should have this in my vehicle so I should know what I'm looking at?
Well, of course, the first part is about its history and the context and how they've been cared for all these years. But at the back, there's a park profile, and each of the 29 parks is listed there, not only with the photograph and how to get there, but also all the features that you can expect to see when you get to each park that was constructed by the Civilian Conservation Corps. Part of the story, too, is Parks and Wildlife wants them to know, wants people to know that they're really a threatened resource. They've been around for a while. Maintaining them takes an interdisciplinary core of people, not only those who work for Parks and Wildlife, but those with whom, architects and engineers with whom we work on the outside. And it's a labor of love. And even though it just struck 1930s Texas as a great windfall, it's a responsibility, but it's one that we embrace and enjoy daily.
Yeah, so these structures are now, I mean, they're pretty old.
Well, this year we celebrated the 80th anniversary, and we did that in Palo Duro Canyon, and we had a few of the enrollees. And what's fun is that some of their children and grandchildren, even though the gentlemen have passed on, their children and grandchildren and people who just love that construction turn up at the reunions that we have. And a few gentlemen who worked on Texas parks and other CCC parks. It's like a national fraternity, if you will. Shared memory, shared experiences in the individual camps, no matter what state you happen to contribute in.
But these structures, I mean, even though they were made out of natural material, the wear and tear has got to be just that years are taking their toll on them, and preserving them has got to be very difficult because of how they were built in the first place by hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're in most cases, there are sturdy structures, and it's certainly the masonry, the stone structures, and they have had a lot of attention as best we have been able to support and fund repairs and maintenance over the years. But I think that those first couple of decades after they were constructed, they were just absolutely so popular, and there was no practice of public support for these parks because it was a windfall. The the federal government did pay for them. It took a while for states and as Texas to fund their maintenance in perpetuity, and so that's what we struggle with, and working with public and private partnerships to try to maintain this legacy that's unique.
Now, when these when the CCC was in force and they were getting kids who and young men who had no place to go and no work, it wasn't just white men; it was also integrated all races.
Mm-hmm. It was integrated at first. It was designed to be so. However, later on, some of the it was tacitly segregated afterwards. And there was so much in some quarters of the country dislike of having African American companies in their community that you had to find communities that were willing to accept African American companies, and those that didn't don't have a park. And some Abilene, they have a stunning park that was constructed by heralded African American companies, and Dangerfield too, which has just been newly remodeled. I'd go there.
There were African-American men who worked on these parks, went to go fight the war, came back home to Texas, and then they weren't allowed to go to the park that they built.
That's correct. We've heard this story a number of times. Millard Fillmore Rutherford was a gentleman who helped build the dam at Fort Parker State Park near Mahia, Texas. And that that area welcomed African-American troops, and it just so happened that Mr. Rutherford was from that area, and after the war, he took his new bride to visit and see the evidence of his handiwork, and he was not allowed to enter the park. So much has changed in that regard, but it really does tell you that was a real different time in our American history.
There's a statue in Santa Fe of a CCC boy. Is there anything like that in Texas where we have some sort of monument to the young men?
Just every one of the 29 state parks that the effort is a pretty much standardized statue, and it is a commercial endeavor.
And are they labeled? Can you, or do you just have to just know?
What's that?
Is there anything?
The statue?
The works, the dams, the pavilions, the park benches. Is there, how do you know it's a CCC?
Well, in most cases, you can tell by, after you take a look at a few of them, you can recognize many of them. Some of them are anomalous, like Indian Lodge out in Fort Davis or Goliad State Park, because they, in one case, Goliad, they were restoring a mission according to their conception of missions in the 1930s. And then they were, and then at Indian Lodge, they were looking toward the west, which is the southwestern Pueblo style. So those are a little bit different, but they're still distinctive. And the others are typically, you know, stone and wood, but they use whatever is locally available. Down in South Texas, for example, they concocted what's called a shellcrete block, and they would.
That's like concrete, but made out of shells.
Mm-hmm. And they would. It would be like fashioning adobe in the south, in the southwest. And actually, what they did for Indian Lodge, but for Lake Corpus Christi, they in Goose Island, there were shellcrete blocks that were used to form the buildings there. So.
One place that looks fascinating to me is the Longhorn Cavern State Park.
Oh, yes, yes. And that was a third one that was very much, there was a great deal of interest in it. It had already been a tourist destination before the 1930s. But that was one that required some a lot of hard labor. There's so many photographs showing people. Showing the CCCers wheel-bearing materials out of the cavern and really having to clean that up. And the architect for that main building, Samuel Vosper, did a remarkable job. That particular building, it's kind of a anthology of stones in the area. I mean, he really was a masterful and fanciful design. I encourage people to go there.
It's about 12 miles southwest of Burnett in Burnett County, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it's just an amazing place to visit. And it's you, once you've gone there, you'll never forget it. So, what do you think is the lasting legacy of these state parks and the construction that was done on them by the CCC? Will they last another 100 years?
We're doing our best. We are doing our best, and we have some. We have some good examples of recent renovations, keeping as much of the original as absolutely possible to protect the integrity of the original construction. We have Dangerfield State Park, and as I said, the cabins at Garner. We're hoping, and about 5 or 6 years ago, Indian Lodge was renovated. The original CCC rooms, that each one is different. People snap those up, reserve those first of all because they're so distinctive. We hope to do some things at Balmoray State Park, Lake Corpus Christi, and Lake Brownwood as well. But I certainly hope so. I would hate for any Texans to not enjoy what we're enjoying today.
Cynthia Brandemart is the director of the Historic Sites and Structures Program at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. She has written the book, Texas State Parks and the CCC, The Legacy of the Civilian Conservation Corps, and how this Depression-era New Deal jobs program built the state parks that we cherish so much today. That does it for this Memorial Day edition of The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening. We'll be back live and interactive tomorrow.